Thank you so much, Bruce, and delighted to be on this panel with such distinguished colleagues. So I'll jump right in since we only have 15 minutes. My presentation this morning is going to focus on what I've entitled the social ecology of suffering. I've been studying this for some time in my capacity as a doctoral researcher. By the way, I have no conflicts to disclose this morning. In my capacity as a doctoral researcher at Fordham University, and also have become involved in a second project more recently as a postdoctoral researcher studying older adults in prison. So those are the, I'm going to talk to you about two populations this morning that I'm interested in. So my goals are to talk to you a little bit about the two populations, the conceptual frameworks I've used, some of the challenges I've dealt with. And my main goal is to talk about expanding consciousness of suffering as a public health problem and some of the ethical practice, policy, and culture change issues that we have to talk about both in nursing homes and in prisons. Just briefly, the perspective and positionality that I bring to these topics is that my background is interdisciplinary, as Bruce mentioned, and I'm really at the intersection of health law and policy, public health, social work, and ethics. So what is the social problem that I'm addressing today? Well, again, I'm addressing persons in marginalized communities, and the first community that I'm going to be talking about is nursing homes. And as you see on this slide, the majority of nursing home residents are women. And as you know, the nursing homes today are operating under very onerous fiscal constraints. With respect to the nursing home residents, the problem of suffering has been understudied. There's been a lot of work done on the problem of pain in the last several years. But it really hasn't extended to the problem of suffering. So that's really been my focus in this research. So my conceptual frameworks, I've drawn upon social ecological theory, Levinas and his conceptualization of the ethical relation and the primacy of ethics. And also I've used phenomenological methods and, of course, drawing upon the phenomenological theory of science, which is very much focused on the humanistic perspective. What does it mean to be a human being? Here are my research questions. What are lived experiences of suffering and decision-making among seriously ill elderly women? What are the possibilities for human development, change, growth, resilience in suffering and decision-making? And what is the role of interpersonal relations in suffering and decision-making? In terms of my data collection and analysis, I spent 6 months in a nursing home interviewing about eight participants. I had four major cases, as you see here. And I'm going to move on and tell you a little bit about my findings. I had some very exciting findings. I identified both individual and general structures of suffering and decision-making, and one general structure of suffering and decision-making based upon analyses of all the empirical data. Two types of suffering were identified within the general structure, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes. So the experiences of suffering that the participants shared with me had a temporal character, which was very exciting. Of course, I spent so much time with them that I was able to really access the temporality of their experiences. And so I identified three moments in their experience. The first moment was a maternal ground that was the foundation of agency, sociality, and spirituality. The central moment was the moment where they transitioned from that ground to cascading losses, threats to those maternal foundations and coming to the nursing home, loss of agency, and being thrust into the vortex of pain and suffering. And then the third moment was as they struggled to move towards some sense of well-being while they were living through that suffering. And I identified this as an intentional, agentic, life-affirming, empathic, care-seeking movement toward well-being. here are examples of some of these moments, and you can just looking at some of the quotes, the testimony that I was able to access from the participants was very, very rich. And here you see some of the social ecology being pulled in, the social context. Here in the first moment, a past life built on maternal foundations. This particular participant was born in the Caribbean, and she described her very, very rich life in the Caribbean, growing up with her mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. Here in the central moment, again, very rich testimony about pain. The same participant, I'll just read you this quote. She describes her pain yesterday morning, yesterday night and morning. This hand hurt me, both, two of them. But this right one here, yes, they're both hurting me, yes. But you feel how tight they are. I have to, yesterday morning, not this morning. Yesterday morning, they hurt me so bad until I wanted to cry out. So here, pain was identified as a multidimensional experience, and one, of course, that involved the lived experiencing body. And then the central moment of suffering was identified as being a multifaceted experience changing over time, pervasive, destructive threat to every aspect of experience involving all of these dimensions, shock, trauma, dislocation, displacement, voicelessness, accumulation of burden, and very much a threat to the futural horizon. And then moving into the third temporal moment, this I found to be one of the most exciting findings of the study, that these participants, as burdened as they were with their pain and suffering experiences, that they were able to experience well-being at the same time as they were suffering. Here, this participant appealed to her caregiver for empathic care, comfort, and security in order to reestablish what I saw as the pain-free home. The home, of course, was very, very central to some of these experiences. And so this was very much a part of that movement. Here's a quote from one of the participants in terms of her expressions of well-being. This was Paula, another participant. She was at the nursing home for about 9 years. So I stayed here, and here I am 9 years, and everything is all right. You have to adapt, trying to adapt little by little with these people, as long as they have to be adapted to myself also, to know me, and that's it. Everything is all right. My family comes to visit me every other week, and I have everything. I live all right. Here's a third participant, and this particular quote, I think, shows how the participants tried to overcome their voicelessness. And in this particular excerpt, you see how the participants turned to their peers for relational empathic care when they did not find that empathic care from the staff. Because I have no voice and I call people and they don't hear me. And so she's, referring to the roommate, my voice otherwise, she'll call for me. Or if I can't get to my bell, she'll ring for me, you know. We get along all right. Only we wish I had more room, because I just have a space where I could sit there, and I have to wait. Waiting was a big theme that emerged, this endless waiting for which there was no end in sight. So here's the general structure that emerged from the study. In terms of high-level generality, there was a loss of maternal foundations and, of course, a loss of agency that were invariant in the structure of suffering and decision-making. And then dropping down to a typical generality, which is a middle-level generality, in this third temporal moment of struggling toward well-being, there actually emerged two types here. The first that I talked about, the agentic, life-affirming, and empathic care-seeking type of well-being. And then one of the studies which was a comparison case, there was evidence of a second death-seeking type of well-being involving a participant who was a very, very tragic case, a participant, actually a male, who was an amputee and who was really, really struggling with his suffering, who found the home actually to be a maternal empathic care-seeking experience because he was really at risk of homelessness when he came to the home, but yet really was turning toward death in terms of what well-being meant to him. Now I'd like to turn to talking for a few minutes. How am I doing time-wise, Bruce?
About 4 minutes.
Okay. Just turning to talking for a few minutes about this study that I've been working on, older adults in prison, and there are some really interesting parallels to the prison between the prison experience and the experiences in nursing homes. So this study was conducted in the New Jersey Department of Corrections, cross-sectional correlation design. Data were gathered from 632 incarcerated male offenders, and here were the measures. As you can see, we measured the pain in the last 30 days. There's the number of days that the participants experienced pain in 30 days, and you can see there's a higher number of days among the chronically ill. And we hypothesized a path analysis relationship between pain, coping resources, and mental duress. And pain significantly influenced coping resources. There was an inverse relationship between pain and coping resources. And also coping resources significantly influenced mental duress. So I think these findings have implications that I certainly would like to pursue in future studies. Obviously, coping resources are very, very key to how participants deal with pain. So this is, I think, you know, very, very significant. Just wanted to share this model with you that I've been working on with my colleague, Dr. Mashey, Social Ecology of Health and Well-Being. And I won't have time to go into it in depth now, but it really tries to capture all of the different aspects of health and well-being in the model. And of course, you see in the center, human agency. That is really the center of the health and well-being model that really drives all of the experiences. And you certainly saw that in my study of the participants in the nursing home. Agency was key. In terms of the implications for ethical practice, policy, and culture change in both nursing homes and prisons. Certainly, attunement to more humanistic, person-centered practice with seriously ill older adults in both nursing homes and prisons, and a focus on reducing pain and preventing and relieving suffering. And certainly, we want to encourage recognition of pain and suffering as public health problems. There hasn't been sufficient attention to these experiences as public health problems. We need interdisciplinary training for both nursing home and correctional staff in relational empathic care and communication, and also development of peer support models. Certainly, we also want to encourage advocacy of what I call maternal nursing homes and prisons, and certainly for the older adults in prison compassionate release policies. With respect to hospice and palliative care, we certainly want to integrate therapeutic models of care into structured living environments. And with respect to the work I'm doing on older adults in prison, we're working to develop therapeutic models, hospice and palliative care, that we can integrate into the prisons. There are about 75 hospices in the U.S., so we do have some models that we can look to. And we're also concerned, of course, about older adults reentering the community. So I just want to acknowledge the mentors and scholars who've helped me with my work, Dr. Wirtz, Dr. Mashey, and, of course, my distinguished colleague, Bruce Jennings. Thank you so much for your attention this morning.